You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Mom? Dad? I know what I have to do now, but I'm afraid. Not for me, but for my friends. They fought so hard and given so much and helped me to understand why you stood up to the Empire and made the sacrifices you did. I wish you could meet them, my new family. I guess in some way you will be with us today when we finish what you started. I want you to know everything I've done and will do began with you.
Ezra, they're bringing her up.
Welcome to the 602 Club, as we have a special supplemental feature for you today. I'm so excited to be coming straight from Lothal. I gotta say, they have really cleaned this place up since the Empire's left. So it's really nice. I really like the city now, and man, there's just not enough graffiti art anymore, though. Like, it's like Sabine went on holiday, so...
It's very clean and just new and fresh.
It's got that new city smell, so... But I'm really excited to be able to sit down and talk about Season 4 of Star Wars Rebels as the show has come to an end. And so, with me to talk about that noble end is, of course, you, as you heard, the one and only Bruce Gibson.
Yeah, I'm so ready to talk about Rebels. We've gone through the whole series, all four seasons now, so it's exciting and sad at the same time to get to the end. But I do love getting to the end of a series because then I know that I've lived long enough to see it through.
Yeah. You know, as I get older, I feel that way too. I'm like, oh, I finally got to see the... That's kind of how I felt. Like, I know this will sound silly, but when episode 3 came out, I was like, well, I've seen the end of Star Wars. Yeah. Like, I know. And of course, now it's like, okay, well, I guess at least I have to live till, you know, episode 9 comes out so I can at least see the end of the episodes.
No, I was the same way after episode 3, and I don't want to die anytime soon, but I literally said when I left the theater, I can now die in peace because I've seen all of Star Wars, but that's not true anymore.
It's absolutely not true.
You guys do realize that all three of us will die before they stop making Star Wars movies.
Probably.
There will be Star Wars that we don't see.
Yes, and as you can hear, folks, the dulcet tones of the one and only Aaron Goins.
What's up, guys?
I mean,
been
not too
a while
much.
Since I've been
it
on
has,
the show.
It has.
Not
it's
for
been
lack
too
of
long.
Trying. I just keep turning you down. So,
yes. You're kind of like the prom date. I have to keep asking over and over and over again. And finally, I guess I can just wear you down. And you're like, okay.
You're like the Steve Urkel to my, I don't know, what was her name again? Laura or something?
I have no idea.
I think so, yeah. Yeah. So, Aaron, do you watch Star Wars or do you just read it? Because you are on Star Wars Bookworms.
Yeah, I do both. I actually, I do watch the movies at least once each. I've seen them, but
at least once.
Yeah, I mean, well, and I'm not even sure if, you know, I mean, Brandly new hired. Has Jon Favreau even seen all the Star Wars movies? I don't even know.
I think he's a pretty big fan, from what I hear.
I bet
he is. I bet he's seen them.
Well, I mean, I know Aaron is a super fan because I'm going to call him out. You were at the basically both parties they did for the end of Rebels. One, when they came back from hiatus, you were out at Lucasfilm. And then you were out in L.A. to see the finale with a bunch of fans as well. So, I mean, hobnobbing it with people like Donald Faison.
Yeah, Donald Faison. If I knew he was going to be there, I would have worn my Star Wars Detours t-shirt. That would have been a cool photo op to be able to take.
That would have been awesome. With Donald Faison. That would have been awesome. I actually love, too, that he's such a fan. Like, I really did not realize how big of a fan he was. And then, of course, his question was phenomenal to Dave. Yeah, let's hope we get that answer. Well, we got to get some semblance of order. I just want to remind everybody, you can find all the shows here on Trek FM over on iTunes at itunes.com/Trek FM. You can find, of course, the 602 Club. Make sure you give us a star rating review. It really does help people find the show. And as you're listening to this one, of course, we've got the Star Wars only feed as well. So if you just love the Star Wars shows of the 602 Club, you can find that feed specifically in its own podcast thread, which is the 602 Club, a Star Wars collection. So make sure you check that out as well. You can find us all over the place wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. We've got the listeners only discussion group, the Babel Conference there. You can find that on Facebook as you just type Babel in the search field, you'll find us. Or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on the menu bar and that'll bring you over there. And last but not least, man, if you've got something to say about Star Wars Rebels and what you liked or didn't like about the show, send us an email. Go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that'll come to me and the host that week, and we can talk to you more. So, guys, we're just going to kind of talk through the season. So we'll start at the beginning, because I hear it's a very good place to start. But the Mandalorian arc is the one that began the season. And it's also, we were all at Celebration. We all got to see those episodes play out, which was very cool, and we got to see them again. So I've seen them probably 3 or 4 times now with, like, rewatches and stuff. And I wanted to ask you guys, because this is the episode that really kind of brought a culmination to leaving off the Mandalorians from the Clone Wars, Sabine's arc, and showing us one of the ways in which, you know, these rebels actually have a huge impact on thwarting some of the Empire's plans with weapons that could be used against us. So to me, this was a fantastic way to start the series and the season 4 of kind of like starting to bring things to a close.
It almost didn't feel as a season starter in a way for me, because the way season 3 played out towards the end, this just seemed to continue that arc. I mean, it was a great start to the season, but it really was picking up from season 3. And if anything, from these 2 episodes, and I forgot that we saw them at Celebration, but you're right, I've seen them a few times now. I really have come to go from liking Sabine's character to her being probably my favorite now in this series, because there's just so much depth in her and the Mandalorians built into the show, and her attachment to her family and the other Mandalorians. I've just come to really appreciate her as a character and the Mandalorians now in this series, and I think it's been fantastic.
Yeah, Sabine's come a long way. Her and Ezra both have come a long way in the show, especially for me as a fan. Just, they were probably the 2 at the very beginning that I wasn't that not as on board with as their, you know, their character types. But you could tell based on the end, how the show ends, and Sabine's importance in how the series ends, that a lot of this, like these episodes in particular and the episodes previous to this where she's doing kind of that lightsaber training with Kanan, they're really taking the time to establish her and the depth of her character and show her importance to the series. And these episodes in particular did a great job of just creating that, you know, giving us more backstory and showing kind of where she came from. So I really like these episodes a lot.
Well, and I like what you're talking about, Bruce, there too, and specifically pulling from season 3. And like you said, Aaron, those episodes where she was training with Kanan were some of the best episodes of season 3. I mean, and some of the most heart-wrenching too. I mean, and so we continue that here with her character, and, you know, we finally get the answer as to what she did that almost destroyed her people, and why she was kind of an outcast with them, but also the way in which she is able then to redeem herself by keeping this weapon out of the hands of the Empire for good, but at the same time reorganizing in a lot of ways the Mandalorians all under one banner finally, with my favorite Mandalorian, Bo-Katan, and having her back as well was just a huge plus. And again, it's something that goes all the way back to the Clone Wars, and so Dave is able to kind of, I don't want to say put a bow on, but he's really able to bring that all together. And I think that's something that season four for, I think, Rebels really does that well. That Dave and the crew behind the series see this as a way to kind of flesh out all the things they were able to do in animation from the Clone Wars to Rebels, and really tie together the prequel trilogy and the original trilogy, and even with some of these episodes, the sequel trilogy too. So it's just like they, and I think this kind of puts us on that path. And gosh, I don't know about you, but part of me kind of wants to see a live action show with maybe these Mandalorians now. I just think that would be kind of a cool place to go. Now that, and you know, we got Jon Favreau, right? Who was Pre Vizsla leading that show. So it's like, it might be not a bad idea to have as a live action show. So I don't know. It's this arc was, I felt like a really strong start. And like both of you pointed out, getting to dive into Sabine's character in a way that I think made her kind of pivotal to everything was great. Because as with what you said, Aaron, I wasn't a huge fan at the beginning of Sabine. But yeah, by the end of this show, she is one of my favorite characters on the show now. And I love that they kind of took all of these characters through that. Ezra is one of them too. It's like he started off as everybody called, you know, Space Aladdin. But now he's this character that I have massive respect for. So I just, this was a fantastic way to start off this season.
Yeah, I think Sabine in a lot of ways is the Ahsoka of this series. Because Ahsoka started off not being a well-liked character in the beginning of Clone Wars by a good many fans. And then she was one of the most loved. And I feel more so with Sabine than maybe with Ezra in this series. I think Sabine was more accepted at the beginning than Ahsoka was at the beginning of Clone Wars. But I feel that she has really matured. And I think Ezra, I guess, has too. So maybe it is kind of the parallel of Ezra and Sabine have really matured since season one to the end of season four. And I think they've become more like characters, because I remember Sabine, people were making comments like, oh, you know, she's just there to, you know, sell toys and appeal to girls and be kind of punkyish, like, and graffiti and all that. And what's really her purpose? It's just, she's just there to appeal to kids. Well, I think they've proven, as they did with Ahsoka, that she wasn't just a character there just to appeal to kids. She appeals to adults, and she's really grown a lot through the series.
And you need to have characters like that, you know, that start out unpolished and maybe even annoying in some ways, you know, like, especially with, you know, I found some of the things that Sabine would do kind of annoying. She would get very offended by certain things. I remember in early seasons where she wasn't included, you know, she had that kind of like teenager mentality, that it's just like, well, why aren't you telling me everything? Or why aren't you treating me like an adult? And, you know, and I'm well past that point in my life, so I don't relate with that mentality as much. So when her character would have those kind of lines, I'd just be like, ah, stop it. You know, just, you know, but they, you have to have a character. You have to have characters like that in a show. They can't all start out, you know, with the end game. You know, you have to be able to show growth. And, you know, I think it, like you used Ahsoka as an example, you know, very similar in how a lot of people had a hard time with Ahsoka at the beginning. But then by the end, she's literally like a top five favorite character of all time for many people. Sabine kind of had a similar route. Although I wouldn't put Sabine in my top five characters of all time, but they definitely brought her from one place where I was just like, okay, she's just part of the crew, to, oh wow, she's the pivotal character, really, that she even gets to do the, the, you know, that the voiceover at the end explaining where everybody ends up, like they picked Sabine of all people to do that. So she's very central to the story.
Yeah. And I also feel like they became the leaders, her and Ezra, because if you, like you're saying, Aaron, she's, oh, why am I not included? Why don't I know? But do you know, towards the end, it seemed more that Ezra and Sabine were taking the lead and saying, okay, this is what we got to do. This is where we need to go. And everybody was kind of following their lead at the end.
Yeah, they needed to pass the torch to the younger generation. You know, Kanan obviously met the end he met. And, you know, at the end, when Ezra's trying to kind of get out of there, he didn't even have to really talk to Sabine. They just made this eye contact, yes, kind of like what to do. And it really did show. And even, I know this is jumping way ahead, but just to kind of tie it into what we're talking about, we do see that everyone just completely respects Ezra by this point at the end.
Yes.
Where they're not questioning his plans anymore. They're just like, hey, you're the leader, you know? And I think I'd put Sabine kind of in that same boat with Ezra.
I really love where you guys have taken this, because it is the thing that, again, and this is a whole season that we're talking about, so I think it's fine to tie it all together, because that's the thing that's so beautiful about this, is that the relationship between Ezra and Sabine, you know, in a lot of ways, it kind of parallels the Kanan and Hera relationship, but without the romance. You know, they just are friends, and they completely trust one another. They have each other's backs. And as, you know, he says to Sabine, I can always count on you. You know, like, they've always been there for each other. They've always kind of been, you know, brother, sister-ish. And what I love is that they show that kind of relationship. It doesn't always have to be romantic. You know, you can have a great male-female relationship that doesn't have to go there. Who knows? I mean, if they had, you know, both been in the same place at the end, yeah, maybe it would have been there, but it stayed in that kind of, you know, brother sister zone, which is amazing and great, and that's what they needed from one another. And I think that's the beauty of this show. But also, I think it was interesting because in a lot of ways, the end of this show parallels a lot of what happened in The Last Jedi about how the torch was passed. And as you guys are saying, Ezra and Sabine are the ones that get the torch passed to them. And by the end, they're the leaders. They're making the plans. And Hera and Zeb are following them. You know, and so that's kind of a lot of what happened in The Last Jedi, where the torch was passed to Poe and Rey. You know, so I think it's kind of neat to see the way, and again, I think this kind of shows the brilliance of Dave Filoni, and he understands George's idea of kind of repeated themes, repeated motifs. And he does that beautifully in everything that he's done, but this really shows up, I think, with Sabine and as arcs. Again, getting to start with the Mandalorian arc was just a great way to do that. So I think it's just a... One, I love seeing more Mandalorians, because I enjoy the Mandalorians, the way that they've been portrayed. And I also like that we finally kind of got them even closer to what we kind of thought of in the EU. But they still have that George Filoni feel. Like, these are closer, but they're still what they are. And I really, really like that. And I love now to be able to get to see more of that. So it's, to me, perfect way to start this season.
What I like is, and I've heard people complain about kind of doing stories that play off Clone Wars. Not everybody has complained about that, but some people are like, Rebels should stand on its own. And they feel like Dave is using this as an opportunity to close out stories from Clone Wars, or playing off thing on Clone Wars, which Rebels should stay on its own. And I disagree with that, because all of Star Wars plays off of each other. And yep. I think,
well, at least the best Star Wars does. Yeah,
well, exactly. And so whatever is established with the Mandalorians and Clone Wars, it makes sense to go ahead and touch on those things in Rebels. And so I do like the arc from the Clone Wars into Rebels, and make the Mandalorians closer to what we think and what we saw, like you said, Matt, in the EU.
Yeah, and it's funny to see kind of, I remember when they decided to bring the Mandalorian culture into the Clone Wars. And remember when it was like this whole like pacifist, you know, culture, and it just didn't look or resemble anything that we thought it was going to be. And everyone kind of freaked out. But then it was like, and I don't know if this was George, you know, knowing what the long game was, or maybe this was just George trying to subvert our expectations. But Filoni, you know, took that, you know, and ran with it. And kind of, although they introduced it as this pacifist culture, they kind of still flipped it and got to the point now that they're at with Rebels, where they do introduce the idea of this warrior culture that was so, that basically decimated this planet and forced them to become pacifists because of that. And there were still these like splinter groups that were still remember the warrior culture. And then there's these clans, and then it does start to look more like what we saw in Legends. And so I thought it was such an awesome, you know, melding of kind of like George's ideas. So you can see Filoni's influence, where he respected what, you know, was in Legends and gave us, you know, a taste of that, but it's also, you know, it's different than what we had from Legends. But I thought they did a really good job of kind of blending it and it making its own thing. So I really enjoyed what they did with the Mandalorians in this series.
Yeah, I 100% agree with both of you. You know, Bruce, you'll get this, but it, and Aaron, I think you will too, because I know you know some about Star Trek, but like, it reminds me so much of what happened with Enterprise, and everybody was like, oh, these aren't Vulcans. But, you know, like, the idea that a culture is a monoculture for its entire existence just doesn't make sense. And George even had that same explanation, and so did Dave, when they first brought the Mandalorians in. You know, look, Mandalorians aren't a monoculture, you know, so we're giving them dimensionality, and we're making this a real feeling culture that is going to have ebbs and flows to it. And the ebb was they almost destroyed themselves, so they became pacifists. And yeah, like you said, Aaron, they just, the way they work that all out, I think really they knew the long game. They knew where they were going to go. And I think that's the beauty of, I think, the Clone Wars and the Rebels series is that there is a clear path of where they're going. So all these stories make sense. And even this season, by the end, did an amazing thing, which was it took some of those shows that were like, oh, that's just a filler episode. That doesn't really. Mm-hmm. Mm. And they took those and they made them mean something at the end of the season and the end of the series. And so, but I think that's because you get a clear understanding from Dave and the writers of where the show is going. So nothing is done on accident. And to me, that's one of the things like that has made, you know, these animated shows specifically so good. And what George started with the Clone Wars and Dave is finished now with this Rebels series is really making sure that all the puzzle pieces fit together and make sense. So to me, that's really cool. And one of the ways they did that is, you know, they had these rebellion links throughout, you know, last season, specifically kind of leading up to some of the things with Rogue One. And this season, we got a couple episodes here with Saw Gerrera as he's returning and trying to undercover this Imperial secret. And he, you know, he's really showing his crazy. And I liked having just one more time to kind of see Saw, to kind of set up what you'll see in Rogue One. I really enjoyed that. But I also think that they were used specifically as growth moments for Ezra, because Ezra at that point is struggling with, how do we fight? How you know, like, he's struggling with that idea of his conversations with Yoda and seeing like we're not getting anywhere. So he has to make that choice in those two episodes and that they help him make the choice of where he'll go. So I like that it wasn't just, oh, we're just giving you Saul so we can connect to Rogue One. It's, no, we're using this as a way to further the character development of Ezra so that by the end of the season, you can understand why he makes the decision he makes.
Well, yeah, because Ezra is really obsessed with getting back to his homeworld and helping them and freeing them from the Empire. And right now, the rebellion isn't focused on Lothal. And so now you have Saul Guerrera pointing out that the rebellion is weak and they're not taking those chances. And Ezra's really learning from Saul that, you know, are we not doing enough? And it kind of, in a lot of ways, it matures him and propels him to push even harder for Lothal and getting back there and trying to do what's best to free them, but also knowing that line and learning that line of, well, what's pushing too far? What's doing too much on the rebellion side of going too far like Saul does? Saul is, in a lot of ways, kind of a criminal on a rebellion side. People die, innocents die. But his opinion is, you know, the innocents must die sometime for us to go forward and free everyone. And so I really did enjoy these two stories. It's episodes 3 and 4 of this season.
Yeah. And in introducing Saul back into the series, especially at this point, is a great way to show kind of where the rebellion is at this point in the timeline. It was even interesting to me that when the Rebels crew showed up on Yavin, they were like, they had no idea what was going on Yavin. You know, that was a different cell. You know, they were part of Phoenix Squadron, and, you know, and then whatever was left of Phoenix Squadron ends up on Yavin as well. And so you're seeing all these separate cells all around, including Saul kind of doing his own thing. And it's just cool to kind of see the very beginnings of what we know as the rebellion. And it wasn't as simple as like, oh, this group all got together, they fought against the Empire, they beat them. Like, it was all these different cells all across the galaxy that kind of banded together. And Saul is such an outlier. You know, he's doing it his way. And he even calls out Mon Mothma, you know, kind of like, hey, you're too soft. This is why you guys are losing. And I loved all of that back and forth.
That scene specifically where he has the hologram and, you know, and Mon Mothma finally breaks, like, you see this break in her, and she starts kind of yelling back at him, like, how he's a criminal and all of these things. And he's like, there's that fire, you know. And I think it's interesting because, you know, Mon Mothma herself is still struggling with, how do we do this? And she even notes there that she still wants to find a solution in the Senate. You know, she still wants to find a peaceful solution. And this is just one more point where she starts to realize, I think, that this is not going to be the case. You know, there isn't going to be a peaceful solution to this. And this becomes one more place where that kind of another nail is put into the coffin of a peaceful solution. And I like that. I think it's important because, again, one of the cool things about the Rebels series is, yes, it is focused on this family, but it also has really helped us understand the rebellion at large. And these are key episodes to doing that. And I think it's just done really well in that they never forget about the focus of Ezra and this family and their part in it, but they're able to use that, but I also furthering other parts of the story. And I mean, obviously, getting the connection of seeing the Kyber crystal, which I loved, you know, of it calling to Ezra, him hearing that, you know, the beautiful call of the Kyber crystal, and all of that was fantastic. The ship getting blown up, you know, because of the Kyber crystal, you see its power. I thought that was just, again, it's just something that's really strong, and it connects with Rogue One, and then, of course, A New Hope so well, seeing all of that play together. So this is one of the places where the interconnectivity is key to the series, but it's also just done with a real precision, so that you never lose the true focus. And you could easily do that. You could easily do what you said earlier, Bruce, like, oh, this is just the way to, like, finish up the you know, Clone Wars series. But Dave never allows it to descend into something like that. He's way too good for that. And so is the team behind Rebels. So I think this episode specifically these two episodes in The Name of the Rebellion really bring that home, really show that.
And Forrest Whitaker is back as the voice of Saw
Gerrera. Oh my gosh, so good. Yeah. Well, and yeah, can we talk about that? You get Forrest Whitaker back, you get Genevieve O'Reilly back, you get later on we're going to get Ian McDiarmid back. You know, we had Frank Oz as Yoda. I mean, so getting all of these main players to come back into Rebels, I think, was something that's really special. I guess they must be that Disney cash.
Yeah, because George didn't do that with the Clone Wars. We weren't getting these people back. I think, and we did have Frank Oz come back as Yoda, though, I think, in that last season, didn't we? Was that Frank? I can't remember.
I can't remember if he was in.
I don't think in the Clone Wars they ever did.
Yeah, I don't think they did. But yeah, it would have been hard to get Ian McDiarmid to play the Emperor and Palpatine that many times.
Right.
He was in the show so much, and he's he's on stage too much for that. So, but these kind of one-offs where you just, it's fantastic. So, the middle of the season, I kind of like labeled occupation because this is where they go back to Lothal and a lot of the story plays out into where we'll get to the end of the season. And I thought it was interesting because, you know, we hadn't been to Lothal since the end of last season, and we get there and it is just, it's awful. Like the world you see is completely different than the world we left, which was this kind of beautiful, luscious prairie land with, you know, these beautiful mountain ranges and everything. And this just looks like, you know, post-apocalyptic planet now. And I really like where they take this story about tying it into everything they had been doing with the TIE Defender project and, more into Thrawn's plans, getting Rook, and some, you know, very, some, the beginnings of some very trippy things happening here on Lothal, where we begin to realize Lothal is a much different place and there's something much more important here than we ever thought, which I just thought all of these episodes actually do that really well in bringing that all together.
Yeah. What I liked about doing that is we started season one almost entirely on Lothal and we got finally away from the planet and we now are exploring other areas and exploring other factions of the rebellion and the empire and all these things. And now we come back full circle back to Lothal. And like you said, Matt, it's a different Lothal. Things have changed just like we've seen our characters change over time. So even though we've only had four seasons, we've had a great progression of both character and environment expand and grow and change throughout just these four seasons. So that's what you want in your storytelling. You want things to change and then come to a conclusion at the end. And I felt like we really got a good arc for Lothal. We got that beginning, and now we've got that end to it. And I really enjoyed being back on Lothal. And I know we're going to get into it, but then just even just the mystery of Lothal by having the Jedi Temple and the wolves and those sort of things happening at the same time, there was just a lot there to me that even though we had less episodes in season four about Lothal, I thought we got more out of Lothal than we did out of the first season where the whole season was devoted to it.
Yeah. And Lothal is one of those planets that it's got such a connection to the Force that it makes sense that the Rebels crew ended up here, you know, and it's kind of like if you think about Star Wars in this way, like how the Force intervenes in characters and kind of placing them where they need to be at the right time. And, you know, Lothal is such a power earth. That planet is so connected to the Force that it almost seems like the crew was drawn there because they needed to meet Ezra because he was going to be so pivotal. And the Jedi Temple that's there is obviously this thing that nobody even realized how important that was going to be. And, you know, even all the big players that we know, including the Emperor himself, is interested in what's going on this planet. So I love how, like, at first, when they first introduce us to Lothal, you're just like, oh, okay, whatever, this backwater planet, no big deal. They just needed a setting. But no, this was a much bigger deal, and we got to see that play out by the end.
And I like that the idea, too, that what was in the Jedi Temple and what we begin to explore here is that this is not some sort of, like, Malachor technology type thing or anything like that, that this is as mystical as it gets when it comes to the Force. And it makes Lothal, like you were saying, Aaron, one of these planets where it's a nexus for the Force in a way that we didn't expect or didn't know. You know, it becomes like Dagobah. It has a Mortis feel almost to it. It's got, you know, any of those planets like Ilum, where it's just so interwoven into the fabric of the Force. Fabric, Force, space, time, continuum. That's what we get. That's what Lothal is. And this Jedi Temple, which we had obviously no idea that this is something that could have been... I get the feeling like this isn't just Jedi who came here, but that those Mortis gods may have been integral in setting up the temple and what that thing is. Like, it feels so much more ancient than even just the Jedi. And so, like, having that kind of connection and realizing that our rebels are so pivotal in, one, we talked about the fact that they keep the weapon that Sabine had created out of the hands of the Empire, so that's huge. And then they are going to be pivotal in making sure that the TIE Defender project doesn't go through, and answering very well the question of why you never see the TIE Defenders again. And then three, they are going to be pivotal in making sure that Palpatine doesn't end up having control over space and time. They become some of the most important people ever to have existed in Star Wars, because without them, the original trilogy goes very differently. I mean, that's what's so amazing about what they do here.
I would love to learn more, and I wonder if we will. This is the type of concept that was introduced into Rebels with this, you know, this temple, this place between, what do they call it? The space between times.
The world between worlds.
World between worlds. Like, this whole idea of a world between worlds is a big thing to introduce into the Star Wars galaxy. And I wonder how much it'll bleed outside of Rebels, or if it's just going to be a thing that they use for Rebels and we don't really hear much about it again. But I am curious, you know, the Emperor obviously was trying to get in there because he felt like there was some power he could gain from it. But then when you hear explanations from Dave about what you can actually do, you know, the whole idea of time travel, he's kind of stripped that away and said, oh, no, you can't actually, like, you wouldn't be able to jump into one of those portals and stay there or affect the time or pull somebody out and then pull them into a different portal so they could time travel. Like, he was kind of explaining, like, once they pulled Ahsoka out, she had to go back in. Like, there wasn't an opportunity that they would have brought her into the current time and had her affect things there. So how much power would the Emperor really have by gaining there? Like, he wouldn't, you know, I'd love to learn more than we've already learned, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I would like to think that you can't manipulate time with these as they're stating. But at the same time, Ezra is able to reach through the portal and pull Ahsoka in, and then, of course, like you said, she went back out. But maybe it's not that what Ezra did was something that happened that he's reaching into the past, but maybe it's just something that it just, I don't know how to explain it. It happened.
Like, it happened. Yeah.
Like,
it always happened.
It always happened. It always happened. Before Ezra went there, Ezra reached out and pulled Ahsoka there. Like, time has already been defined. Time has already been established.
It does seem like you can affect other parts of time. Like, he obviously affected what happened between her and Vader because he was able to pull her out just in time to not get killed by Vader. So he had an effect on time. But he wouldn't have been able to actually jump in there and fight with her, it doesn't seem like. So it's kind of, you know, they haven't defined the rules, and I think that's probably good because then it allows us to speculate and it makes it more fun. But it is interesting to try to figure out exactly what the Emperor would be able to do. You know, what if he was able to figure out how to get in there, you know, what damage could he do to the galaxy? What advantage would it give him?
Well, this is something I think that's really cool because in the episode The Kindred, this is where the wolves are able to have access to this world between worlds because that's how they travel from one part of the planet to the other. They literally go into the world between worlds and then they come back out the other side. So they have some connection in that way. And I like what you're saying, Aaron. I love that there's so much mystery around it because in the end, again, I feel like, you know, like George, he never told you where Yoda comes from and he never will. Like he was never going to tell you where Yoda came from, what his species was. It was better to have the mystery of Yoda and who he was than to just spell it all out for you. And I kind of feel like the world between worlds is that way too, as well as the way that the intricacies of how the wolves are connected to the Force and how all that works, you know. But as per what the Emperor could do, I got the feeling like obviously this world between worlds to me, one, it reminded me so much of Narnia with the Magician's Nephew, where they go into the wood between the worlds and they're the different pools and you can jump into them into different worlds. So it's very similar to that in that way. But I got the feeling like this is Ahsoka says it's ancient. So it feels like, again, something that connects with Mortis and those gods there and those beings as this way of being able to and the wolves specifically say in the episode Doom that it's knowledge. So this is a way to have knowledge and I guess probably wisdom by being able to see what's happening in other times or how things play out or whatever. So specifically, this is about knowledge for yourself and not necessarily just about affecting, you know, like jumping through portals and, you know, just like, hey, let's go to the world between worlds. Anybody want to go to the, you know, Old Republic time period today? All right, let's do it. You know, this is not a TARDIS.
Right.
You know, Star Wars TARDIS. So it does seem to be much more. Dave, I get the feeling like he has some pretty specific world rules for how this works. So, but yeah, I mean, this middle part of the season does such a great job of setting all that stuff up so that once we get to when that kind of stuff happens in the season, I think it's really well done.
So what do you think Palpatine wants with this world between worlds?
I think Palpatine specifically thinks he will be able to use this to control time and space for all eternity. And I think given enough time to understand it and to be in it, he would have that opportunity. I think he would break all of the rules that are around it and create a empire that lasts millennia. You know, that would be his goal. And that he wouldn't care about, obviously, any of the quote-unquote rules of this place. Ahsoka instinctively seems to know them. Being there, it's almost as if she can feel that. Plus also, I mean, again, she has the connection to the daughter. So I think she even has more of a connection to this place and understanding it. And she instinctively knows, no, you can't just go jumping into all these portals and, you know, affecting time. That's not the way this works. That's not how any of this works.
Right. Right. It's not.
That's not how the Force works.
It's not a Bajoran wormhole either.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it doesn't seem that. But also, too, the danger we saw of Palpatine with his Sith magics being able to almost pull himself in because there was somebody there that could allow him to finally enter. Like, he couldn't get there by himself.
Yeah.
There had to be something else in the world between worlds grounding so that he could pull himself in.
Well, he's obviously got a portal in front of him if he's standing there and he's shooting fire through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I liked, I also liked the feeling that Ahsoka's lightsabers maybe are a little bit more special than normal lightsabers, as they had an impact on his Sith magics, which I don't know if we've ever seen before. of them being able to disrupt something like that. So maybe feel like that there's something more special that obviously by the end too, we get that feeling, but
I don't think we've ever even seen Palpatine or any character use that type of attack before.
No, because the last time we saw that bowl, was
the Clone Wars,
you know, in the Clone Wars. Yeah. At the end of, the Yoda arc where, Dooku and Sidious attack Yoda on Moribond. So
yeah, it kind of reminded me of like, because I think Dave was using the terminology, he was using Sith alchemy at that point. Mm-hmm. He's like casting spells almost, which then reminds you of like the Night Sisters and
yes, kind
of that blending of the magics and the Force. And I thought that was kind of cool to see. You know, Palpatine's that type of character that he's not going to just straight up use the Force. He's going to use the Force in any way he can possibly use to give himself an advantage. And so he's probably out there really researching all the other groups that use the Force, you know, all the other dark side and probably light side groups out there that are tapping into this power. And so he's not just going to just shoot Sith lightning at you. You know, he's going to use he's going to use magic and alchemy and whatever he can to try to figure all this stuff out and gain power.
Well, I mean, as we're talking about the wolves and the worlds and the doors and all of this, I was ecstatic. I squeed like a child when they saved Ahsoka. And so I wanted to ask you guys how you felt about that. Obviously, this is before we got to the very end and we see that reveal. But how did you feel about the way that they utilized her in that episode and obviously giving it just a little bit more of a glimpse of the fact that she really did live, as you know, that she walks down at the end, you know, into further into Malachor, we see that she lived.
Ahsoka lives? Really? Oh my gosh. You know,
name of the show, Ahsoka Lives? Question mark?
If they do any other show or anything about Ahsoka, let's stop the whole Ahsoka alive or dead stuff. I mean, that's going to start to get old after a while. That almost would be like, ooh, did Phasma really live through The Last Jedi? I don't know. I'm going to get a shirt that says Phasma Lives just for you, Matt. You can wear it.
And a question mark?
Right. But I thought it was brilliant. First of all, the episodes that we're talking about where Ezra is in the void is probably my favorite episodes of any of the Rebels seasons and any of the episodes that have gone on in the four seasons. But but I would say that Ahsoka coming into it just made it even more special, because walking through that void, like, who else better than maybe like Yoda showing up to explain things, or even Obi-Wan? That would be cool. But I think it was more appropriate to be Ahsoka, because I think of the connection with Mortis, as you were saying, Matt. And when Ezra saw Ahsoka and was able to reach in and bring her in, I love that, because it wasn't just did Ahsoka survive the battle with Darth Vader, but it was Ezra that apparently saved her, an older Ezra. And I just thought that was really cool. And then using her wisdom and guidance for Ezra through the void of what not to do and what to do was just like spot on. I mean, again, you think about that character she was in that first season of Clone Wars and where she is now. Man, I mean, this character has just grown completely. I mean, she's so different than what she used to be.
Yeah, I'm kind of two minds of it, actually. I really love Ahsoka as a character, and I think the way they decided to bring her back and use her, it did make sense. And then especially since you kind of see what happens at the very end where she shows up and her and Sabine seem to be going on some sort of a, you know, quest together. One thing that does kind of annoy me about Star Wars sometimes is their inability to commit to a character dying. And I think that I like the idea of Ahsoka facing off against Vader, sacrificing herself so the rebels could survive, and that being a fitting end to that character. But I think they couldn't resist the temptation and the fan service, if I'm going to use that term, fan service, to bring this you know, popular character back. And I think as a fan of Star Wars and a fan of that character, extremely excited to see her back. But just from a story perspective, I think I may have preferred her to kind of that be her end, and then they focus more on the rebels moving forward.
I so agree with you, Aaron, but I will say that's why I was thrilled that he didn't rescue Kanan.
Yeah.
Because I thought once he brought Ahsoka in, I was like, oh, of course, Kanan didn't really die now because Ezra's going to save Kanan and then everything's going to be happily ever after. And when he decided not to do it, when she convinced him not to do it, I was like, good, because it just opens up that void of just saving anybody at any time. And now it becomes like any death is worthless because, oh, well, anybody could go through this world between worlds and go through the void and bring anybody back through the gateway. And now we've established that that's not necessarily going to happen, nor we don't know if it can happen.
Yeah. And I mean, I love Kanan, favorite character in all of Star Wars. But if they had saved his life in that way, I would have been very upset. You know, I, and like I was kind of saying for Ahsoka, I felt like that was a fitting end for Kanan, and that by bringing him back into the show, as much as I love that character, it would have tainted his story. I'm not saying that bringing Ahsoka back was a mistake. I'm very 50-50 on it, but I'm also super excited about, you know, what we saw at the very end, you know, and her in that awesome outfit with the robes, and she's meeting up with Sabine and they're going to find Ezra. Like, that potential story is totally worth bringing her back.
I do think Ahsoka is different than Kanan at this point. And part of that is, I think, obviously, just to spoil it, at the very end when we see Ahsoka, there is something completely different about her. In the sense of who she is, what she represents. I mean, Dave cannot resist his Lord of the Rings allusions, and she is clearly, you know, Ahsoka the White, in the sense that there is something that has gone beyond all conventional means. Like, she is a completely different type of character, and in some ways, I think, you know, it seems as though she's somewhere between a Jedi and a Mortis god on the spectrum of what she is. And I think that the understanding of what she will be then is going to be very interesting. And so for her to live, I definitely, you know, when we're talking about kind of expanding the universe and what it all means and everything, I think is really interesting. And of course, you know, I love to just her talking to the convoy, you know, saying, you know, actually, Morai is her name. Like, that's the name of the daughter. We never knew that before. So, kind of cool to get those connections. And so, I don't know. I'm probably too much of a fan of Ahsoka. She's my favorite.
Yeah. You
Star Wars female character.
You just compared her to a god. So yeah, you're,
yeah. It is a little bit tainted. But what I also think is pivotal in that scene, and we skipped the Kanan end. We're going to talk about all that, so don't think we're just skipping things. But what I love is that she is the pivotal key to unlocking the final lesson of Kanan for Ezra, and that it makes sense because she just learned that lesson as well. And so they're learning it together, and it makes sense, but it's also beautiful because it's the lesson that Anakin couldn't learn. It's the lesson that a lot of Jedi couldn't learn. And both Ahsoka and Ezra show themselves, and Kanan all show themselves to be the best kind of Jedi in the end. And the fact that it's Ahsoka helping Ezra learn that lesson at that moment was beautiful, because when she says, "You can't save your master, and I can't save mine either," it's just heartbreaking. Like, it's just absolutely heartbreaking. The beauty for Ahsoka is, and she won't, it'll be interesting to see if she ever gets and learns the story of Anakin turning back. That would be kind of a beautiful short story to read. Hint, hint, Del Rey, hint, hint. But, like, that it's not going to be her that can reach him. She knows that now. She can't save him. And I wonder how that affects. This just came to my mind. I just finished the novelization for The Last Jedi, and Luke has a little line in there. He adds a little bit more about when he's talking to Leia. He's like, "I can't save him. I know that I can't save Ben." Well, Ahsoka says the same thing about Anakin. She can't save him. But is there somebody else that can save Ben? The same way there was somebody else that could reach Anakin? I don't know. Maybe they're setting up that connection. So
possibly. But I don't know who would save him. That's the thing.
Are we switching to trilogy talk now?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just a random question that came up because I just put those two things together, you know, that, you know, Ahsoka clearly knows she can't be the one to save him, but he will be saved.
Maybe there's something with, yeah, going to the sequel trilogy. Maybe there's something between Rey and Mortis we don't know. I doubt it because they'd have to explain that in the movies, but, you know, and maybe she's the one that saves Ben, but that's a whole nother discussion.
I think that there's a veil that will not be broken between, you know, some elements in the television shows and the movies. If they were going to introduce something like Mortis, we would have already heard about it in one of the other films. But I don't know. Like, selfishly, for me, because I don't like the character of Kylo Ren. That's not true. I like the character. I don't like him. I want him to die. I think he's a great character, but he's evil. I want him to die. I kind of hope they flip it than what they did with the original trilogy and kind of the redemption arc for Anakin. I hope that this isn't the same type of story, where it's a redemption arc for Kylo. I hope it's different.
I'm actually right there with you. I mean, I don't want that either. Having just read the novelization for it, just brought back, you know, this connection, and I don't know, you know, and it makes it interesting that they could go either way because they have precedent for it now.
Definitely. It's definitely a good call out, because as much as I don't like the idea of him being redeemed, I don't think it's impossible that that's where they're going with the story. And they're setting things up that, you know, that line that you quoted from Luke is a perfect example of, like, he's saying, yeah, I can't save him, but that doesn't mean somebody else can't. We've seen a character, you know, as far gone as Darth Vader, who did all the atrocities that he did and was still able to be redeemed by his son. So, you know, if Vader can be redeemed, anybody can be redeemed, really.
Well, and they could have been setting that up also, because the thought was to have Leia redeem him. But
yeah, it could have been.
Not gonna happen.
Totally quick aside. I was talking about this last night with my brother-in-law. Can you imagine being Kylo Ren and now Luke can just haunt you all the time? I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not he could be the world's most obnoxious force.
That's
ghost.
How Mark Hamill would probably be.
It's exactly how Mark Hamill would do it. And then he'd just put his hand through him and he'd be like, I'm still not touching you. I'm not touching you.
I could
see
Mark Hamill doing that. If Mark Hamill passes away before Harrison Ford, that's what he's going to haunt Harrison Ford with. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. Get out of here, kid.
Okay, we do need to talk about Kanan's noble end, because I think there. Let me put it this way.
That was spoiled by John Williams' soundtrack, by the way. For me.
Totally spoiled by John Williams' soundtrack. But there were a few things in this season where I would be watching an episode and I just find myself, and I'm going to be honest, I was tearing up because there were just moments where it was just like, it was too much. I had come to care about these characters in a way that I did not expect. And Kanan and his connection with Hera and the rest of the team and Ezra and everything and his end was one of the very best things that this show has done. Like, it was done, I think, perfectly.
It was one of the best things that Star Wars has done.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, his character, I mean, from the get-go, I kind of figured I'd like him. He tends to fall into that character type that I tend to be drawn to. And so I kind of knew
roguishly handsome Jedi Knight, which I mean, I consider you one of those.
Yeah, definitely. I like my men roguishly handsome and Jedi Knights. There are some of the qualifications. But yeah.
Gosh.
But no, I mean, he's just that, like, and I hate to use this term because it's so shallow, but he's just cool. You know, he's just a cool character and kind of what I always imagined a Jedi would be like, that's kind of how I imagined Luke would be, you know, post Return of the Jedi, you know, in his prime. That's how I imagined other.
Sadly, he wasn't.
Well, we don't know. There was a lot of time we didn't get to see. So there maybe was a time period that Luke was like that.
I want to put this out there in the internet ether. As John Mills, I'm giving you all credit for this, my friend, and copyright John Mills, 2018, Luke Skywiner.
I'm not jumping on that one right now, but yeah. Kanan, just, I loved Kanan throughout the show. And I think they showed the relationship between a master and a Padawan that we never really got to see with Obi-Wan and Anakin. You know, Anakin was different, you know, Anakin was always chasing power and, you know, feeling like he was slighted. And he was just kind of that bratty teenager. And Ezra had his bratty teenager moments too, but I really liked that relationship between Kanan and Ezra. And then we got to see kind of the parental relationship between Kanan and Hera. And then when they give us the ending that they gave us with him, where Kanan, you know, does the kind of, he shows amazing amount of force ability enabled in his ability to hold back the blast, but also the focus to make sure he saves the people he cares about. And he's saving his apprentice. He's saving the person he loves. He's saving all of his friends. And it's just the perfect ending for a Jedi Knight. Like any Jedi Knight, that's how they want to go out, you know, like doing right and saving their friends. And I don't think they could have written a better ending for Kanan, for me as a fan. And just the whole, like, top it off with like him looking at Hera and his eyes clear up. And oh my goodness, it was perfection.
His eyes clear up, mine tear up. It's, you know.
Yeah, which I didn't catch the first time about the eyes clearing up. I saw that when I rewatched it. So I do feel like this was a great way to end his character. And yeah, I mean, this is one of the first times we really get to see a Jedi outside of Obi-Wan in Clone Wars, but really focus so much on that relationship between Kanan and Ezra and Kanan as the Jedi Master. But for me, in this episode, didn't work as well as it did for most people. And I think it's because, just the way it played, it had those tropes of, oh, the couple is getting back together, you know, is getting together. They're confessing their love for each other. And I'm like, okay, here we go. Kanan's dead. I mean, it's like, I saw it coming and I kept waiting for it. And then he lost his lightsaber and I was like, okay, this is it. Oh, nope, not yet, but it's coming. And I guess the thing I was disappointed is I could see it was coming. And I think one reason I was expecting is because I knew we were nearing the end of the series. If this series was still going on for another few seasons, I wouldn't have seen it coming probably. But I will say rewatching it, because I did a whole binge watch of season 4, I think it played better for me watching the previous episodes leading into it, because there is that confession and that almost kiss again between Kanan and Hera, that it didn't seem as obvious going into this episode. It just seemed natural that they were confessing their love to each other because it was building up. I think it's because this episode came on after a break of like a month or two. It had that distance for me that didn't work when played together with the other previous episodes. I didn't get choked up, but the second time I watched it, I got choked up when Ezra went over to Zeb and Zeb's like, you know, what happened? And he's like, he's gone. You know, Kanan's gone. He's like, kidnapped. And I mean, that's why I lost it. When Zeb hugged Ezra, I'm like, no.
Chopper grabs Hera's hand and you're just like,
like,
it just, you're turning the knife in your heart.
Why am I tearing up?
They definitely telegraphed his death, but I'm trying to think back, like, if they had done it differently where they completely blindsided us with his death, I feel like it wouldn't have meant as much. Like, it might've been a cool like way to do it and like catch you off guard and you're like, oh man, I didn't see that coming. But then they wouldn't have had those moments in those goodbyes that I think those characters needed. So I totally get where you're coming from though, Bruce, yeah. Because you're right. There were moments where I'm just like, oh, okay, here we go. Like, you know, she finally said, I love you. You know, his lightsaber falls off the edge of that building. I think that was kind of the first giveaway for me once he lost his lightsaber. I'm like, doesn't he kind of need that? You know, so I totally get where you're coming from, but I feel like they almost had to do it the way they did it.
Yeah. And again, the second time I watched it though, I noticed that when Kanan sees Ezra and Sabine off, he stops him for a second. Hey guys, may the force be with you. As if he was saying that as his last words to them. I almost felt like Kanan knew that he was dying.
Yeah.
That he knew it was
and
coming.
I think Filoni said as much in the Q&A, kind of like he, even with the whole like cutting his hair and kind of that transformation before he goes off into that mission, I think he pretty much knew he was going and not coming back.
The thing that worked so well for me about it is, I mean, obviously knew it was coming. I was heartbroken to see his lightsaber fall into the hands of Price. I love that lightsaber. Kanan's lightsaber is an amazing lightsaber. But the thing that works so well for me is the way that Kanan proves himself to be, and Ezra does this too by the end of the series, they both prove themselves to be what the Jedi should have always been, what they should have continued to be, and which is basically the, you know, the warrior monk out among the people, helping, and it's a brilliant job that they show. In fact, Kanan even shows how a Jedi Knight can have attachment and still be a Jedi Knight and still do the job that he's called to do. He just realizes the limitations he has. He gives the responsibility for that mission to Ezra because he correctly calls out, because of the way I feel about Hera, I can't be trusted to make the best decision. So so again, you really do show the ways in which the Jedi could have been if they hadn't been so dogmatic. And Kanan and Ezra, I think, prove themselves to be as close to the perfect Jedi as possible. Like, of any Jedi we've ever seen, Luke, Yoda, Obi-Wan included, these two show how it's done right in the sense that they also die well, you know? I don't know. There's something about these two that I think does not get enough credit, even in fandom. And I think their renown as Jedi is only going to grow. And honestly, Aaron, you called it out earlier, but this is exactly what I hoped Luke would be between 6 and 7 and through the sequel trilogy. And sadly, he wasn't.
Yeah. And we get Luke at such a further point in the timeline. And we don't know everything he did between, you know, Return of the Jedi and The Last Jedi. I would love to see some stories that fill that gap in to kind of see where he got to that point, mm-hmm. why he was so, you know, just down on himself and kind of sitting on this island, just kind of waiting to die. There is a big disconnect there between a character that we see at the end of Return of the Jedi with this positive outlook that's going to reestablish the Jedi. And then what we get in The Last Jedi, there's a big disconnect. And I think there's an opportunity with all of that time for them to give us a story or stories where we do get to see Luke in his prime. And we do get to see a more Kanan like Luke, which sounds weird when you're trying to like compare who is like kind of the essential Jedi out there, like Luke Skywalker. You're saying, oh, I wish he was more like Kanan, you know, like a character from an animated series that a lot of fandom probably doesn't even know exists.
Of me doesn't want that though, because like if Luke was more like that and he descends into what he is in The Last Jedi, I almost just never want to know because I don't want any more disappointment.
It would lead
Luke is so much a disappointment but I don't know. That's just me personally.
I love how the interconnectivity of Star Wars that you can't talk about Rebels without talking about the sequel trilogy. Like
it
all connects,
it's amazing.
Which is great. So now we're jumping back into the sequel trilogy, apparently. I think that with Luke, and I see what you're saying there, you almost don't want to see him at that point. But I think that it would be nice to see him in his prime and then see the fall. And then the end of The Last Jedi might mean a little bit more because we get to see him have that triumphant moment at the end. So he kind of comes back to himself. And I think because we never got to see him in his prime, then when he does have his triumphant moment at the end of The Last Jedi, it didn't mean as much. And now I'm obviously I had more issues with The Last Jedi than a lot of people did. So a lot of people really liked what they did with Luke. But there are a decent amount of fans that didn't. So I think for me, I do want to see more. I want to see more of what he was doing after Return of the Jedi.
Well, and I will say this, Bruce, you and I talked about the Legends of Luke Skywalker book, and some of those stories, Luke feels a lot like this. The ones that were really good in that book, I did feel that about Luke. He felt a lot like that, which was great.
That's how I feel he's probably been through most of his time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
we just didn't get to see it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What leads him to be a huge whining baby at the end? I don't know.
Well, he started off that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He just reverted. He reverted back. To me, Kanan's noble end is aptly, it's just that he is, to me, he honestly reminds me of all of the old Jedi. He reminds me most of Obi-Wan in that sense. Like Obi-Wan was able to do the right thing with Satine. He was able to let her go. Kanan's able to let things go. For me to be able to say this is huge, but I think he transcends even where Yoda goes because he fully is able to be everything that a Jedi should have been, even more so than Obi-Wan, because he transcended the level of being allowing himself to be able to have a relationship with somebody and still not allow that that attachment to cloud the moment he was needed most. In fact, I love Ahsoka is saying that to Ezra, how Kanan found the moment that he was needed most and he met that challenge. And I think that's just kind of a beautiful thing. It's even a great life lesson. I feel like Rebels, again, kind of does the very thing that George wanted to do in the very beginning. He used to show stories that teach great lessons for us to be able to learn, even as adults, you know? Like, where's the moment that I'm needed most in my life? And I need to continue to look for that at those places. So, Kanan's a good example of how to live. So, I think that's really cool.
Kanan's kind of from that Qui-Gon Jinn school of Jedi.
Yes, yes, like, I think
Kanan, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Qui-Gon, they seem very similar. And maybe we may have learned a lesson from, kind of the, if it seems like Kanan and Ezra did so well as Jedi, that maybe Jedi do better in, as a master and Padawan kind of on their own, they, instead of having this council that you're constantly reporting to, or this larger temple that you have to go back to, maybe they work better as these almost like, gypsy, characters that kind of travel around the galaxy, just helping people. And they're not necessarily going out on specific missions. They're just, they're where they let the Force guide kind of where they go instead of a council.
Yeah, I can so see that, because I think what we saw in this series is I think Ezra made Kanan the Jedi he became. Because if you go back and you read A New Dawn, and I know that's not, necessarily a part of the series, but when we see Kanan early on and we see some of it in season one, he's kind of reckless. He's not the ideal Jedi. And it wasn't until Ezra came into his life where he had to take that responsibility and now be a mentor. And all of a sudden, I think because of Ezra, he found his path to be a Jedi, because he didn't have that influence through those dark times. And Ezra brought him back to that and made him focus and centered on being a Jedi.
I will say that Rebels does the Last Jedi story better than The Last Jedi, because that's exactly what Rey was meant to be for Luke, right? This story of Ezra and Kanan is a mirror for that story. Kanan doesn't want to be a Jedi anymore. It is Ezra that reignites the flame of the Force and the Jedi, true Jedi spirit in Kanan. And he becomes a better Jedi because of his Padawan, and vice versa, obviously. And it's kind of the story that I hoped for Luke too, right? Like
his story isn't over though.
But here, it really had. I think it, at least here, just within Rebels, you see a picture of how the Jedi can function in a way that is perfectly in line and in tune with the Force, the way they always should have been. And I think, again, Ezra and Kanan are just a great picture of, hopefully, you know, what, you know, in the sequel trilogy, Rey will learn, right? Through her ancient Jedi texts and the legend of Luke Skywalker. And who knows? Well, you know, she could always run into Ahsoka and Ezra. So.
Unlikely.
Unlikely, but wouldn't, yeah, raises a lot of questions. Anyway, okay, so let's get to the end. Freeing Lothal and the finale here with the last three episodes. Just, I was blown away by the way that this series brings itself to an end. And the way that it brings full circle so many of the different things that we had seen. Like, well, Bruce, we got puffer pigs.
Yay.
And we got Purgle, and all of these things that kind of take little bits and pieces of Rebels to make those episodes more important than you thought they would be. And honestly, it reminded me of the way that J.K. Rowling plants seeds throughout all of her books, so that by the time you get to the very end, all of these little things mean something that you didn't expect to mean something, but they came really important. And to me, that's fantastic storytelling. And so it created a finale that allowed me to enjoy the full season, the full series of Rebels in a way that I hadn't before this happened. And that is a successful end.
Yeah, because it's going to make it more fun now to go back and watch those episodes, which we thought were, quote, fillers. And now you're going to watch them in a totally different way, especially when it comes to the puffer pig, too. But no, not really. And
I didn't even catch that there was a puffer pig in it.
Well, it wasn't in the finale, but it was a couple episodes before that, I think. So, but there was a bunch of little puffer pigs. But the Purgle, I was a little disappointed that they were in the atmosphere, because I like to think of them as whales that exist in deep space and not float in gravity. But, you know, they've got some weird force connections, I guess. I mean, to me, that would be like seeing a whale from the sea come out and just run around San Francisco or something. It's like, no, they belong in the water.
I hate it when that happens. Oh, another whale attack.
I like that Syndulla, their kid is named Jason and spelled the same way as Jason from the EU.
Yeah, hopefully he doesn't turn into a huge jerk and destroy the galaxy. But
yeah,
that was an interesting, it's funny how like different people have different reactions to different things, and you either love it or hate it. But that I know that was a big, you know, either love it or hate it type of moment. Like when I heard the name Jason, I was like, oh, I wonder how they spell it. You know, it was the first thing I thought, just because, you know, you think of Jason Solo from Legends. And then, you know, you look at the subtitles, and they did spell it the same way. And so it's like, oh, that's kind of a nice nod. You know, I feel like we've had things like that happen before with characters where it's like, oh, we're not going to ever bring Jason Solo into canon. So why not just, you know, have another character with the same name kind of as a nod to it? They had to be aware of that. I don't think it was a coincidence that they named him Jason and spelled it that way. But there are plenty of people out there that were like, well, how dare they use that name kind of thing, you know? So, yeah, you can't please everybody.
I loved it. I mean, the only thing was that I looked to my wife and I was like, when did that happen?
Like, that's what I was wondering.
So I'm rewatching the series. I'm pretty sure it happens in the episode, The Kindred. There's a couple of points in there where Hera and Kanan are have alone time. And, it could have happened before their conversation or after their conversation at the beginning of the episode. So
you don't think he came back as a Force ghost and that's when it happened?
It's definitely no, I don't think he's birthed by, you know, Kanan's midichlorians. So
I mean, I think it's funny that people are trying to pin down exactly, you know, oh, when would it, I mean, like, what are they obviously were in a romantic relationship. I mean, it's that happens when you're doing that stuff.
It's official. They were space married. Okay.
They totally were. Yeah. I mean, and it actually came as a surprise to me because I was having this conversation with my Star Wars Bookworms co-host, Teresa Delgado, after, you know, after his death. I turned to her and I was like, oh, it's too bad that, like, you know, there's no way that Hera's pregnant, because that would be cool if she had a child, a Kanan's child, so she could have something to kind of remember him by and like a part of him still with her. And, but we both were just like, yeah, there's no way that this show is going to go there. You know, that it's just, it's a kid's show. You know, you don't necessarily want to, you know, kind of open those questions up, you know, with your children when, you know, you're watching the show, like, oh, wait,
mommy, how did Hera have a baby?
Yeah, so it's like, oh, I don't think they're going to go there. And then we're watching it and it happens and they show this kid and I'm like, oh, wow. Like I thought that would be a cool thing and I wrote it off and it actually still happened. So it was, I think it's cool. I thought the character, the kid looked kind of weird. I don't know why. Like, you know, if you mix a human and a Twi'lek, like you would think it would look a little more Twi'lek-ish.
You get green hair.
I don't know. Is the green hair a dyed green hair? You know, is he just, you know, or is it really?
I mean, he does have Aunt Sabine, right? So.
Right. Yeah. That influence maybe. But I think it's cool. I think it's cool to have a kid. It would be cool to see him play a role in, you know, future stories. Maybe go on a mission to go recover his dad's lightsaber or something. But I think there's a lot of story that can still be told with these characters, and they introduce, you know, a character like him who, you know, who knows if he's force sensitive or not, but you know, that's a nice option for them for stories, for future stories.
I mean, I hope he is. I mean, I think it would be really cool to have him force sensitive and maybe be a part. I mean, heck, you could see him in The Last Jedi and you don't even necessarily have to make a big deal of it, right?
Yeah, like a background character or something.
Yeah. So
maybe he's one of the Knights of Ren.
well, let's hope not. Or what would be worse is if he was part of the original Luke's temple and then was murdered
and then died.
So let's not have that happen. So I really enjoyed the way that Dave used the Purrgil in the story. I thought what made that so wonderful is that it tied into the end of season 3. And that Thrawn is unable to, the way to trip up the master chess player is to put a piece on the board that he doesn't understand. And Thrawn doesn't understand anything that has anything to do with the force and or nature. That he thinks purely in technological and psychological terms. He's not thinking about the way that these natural force-sensitive things have an impact on the world. But Ezra, on the other hand, we have seen throughout the entire series be somebody who connects. He connects to people. He connects to nature. He connects to everything that is around him. And it really brings to light the way in which all that is natural and beautiful in the galaxy helps destroy all that is bad about technology, in the same way that the Ewoks are a part of the, you know, the battle in Endor and destroying the Empire. They're pivotal in that. You know, the things that you don't expect around you that the Empire just, you know, doesn't even think about, that's what becomes their downfall. And I really liked what that represents in the Star Wars galaxy, and that's why I feel that it works. It's not just, you know, Deus Ex Purrgil, right? It's actually something that really fits with everything that George had created in the Star Wars galaxy. So, to me, when they came in, I just kind of like, again, I was kind of squeeing like a kid because it made so much sense to me.
Yeah, and it's nice, too, that the way that ended with them going into hyperspace leaves that door open. And it's not, you know, there was questions, will Ezra still live after the series? And that's kind of left open-ended. And I think Dave has since then said, yeah, he's still alive. And I assume that both he and Thrawn are. But I think those are two characters that people were wondering how they were going to be resolved at the end of the series. And instead, it's left as a question mark. And I like that because it leaves the door open to go any
Thrawn
direction.
Thrawn lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll get you that shirt too. And I think Thrawn, you know, you can make your own like assumptions of what's happened to them. And you brought up Ewoks. I'd like to think that they went to, you know, Endor, and the Ewoks are just stabbing Thrawn over and over again, just teasing him.
Just a worse way to die.
Yes.
I mean, just from watching it, like without hearing the Q&A, without hearing anything that Filoni said afterwards, because he did clarify a lot of things when it came to this stuff. But just from watching the show, after I was done watching the finale, I was convinced that Ezra lived. You know, they made it pretty clear just from watching the show, right. Ezra was definitely alive. But I was completely convinced that Thrawn, there's no way he would have survived, you know, jumping through hyperspace without any, you know, with the windows butt bashed out, you know, completely exposed to hyperspace and wherever they end up landing, you know, they're going to be in space.
Right. Well, I mean, they could have jumped to another planet, right? Like we've seen Han do that, jump into the atmosphere right. of a planet.
It's definitely something that we've seen, but it's not common.
Well, you know, but know neither are Purgle coming to save the galaxy.
Right,
so.
Yeah. But I mean, even just traveling through hyperspace, I guess now we know you don't need windshields to travel through hyperspace. But
apparently not.
Yeah, I thought.
Well, is it Ezra keeping them alive through the Force too? I mean, he is holding. Ezra was literally holding everything together, like the bashed in window. The glass hasn't moved; it's still hanging in the air. So it's as if Ezra is holding all of that together, and we've seen his strength. So
Dave has now said, like he's clearly said that Thrawn is alive. So we know he's alive. And so now it's, you know, if you want to go and start explaining how it could have happened, sure. It could have been a force bubble. It could have been the ship had some built-in security feature that dropped the force field before they jumped into hyperspace. Like there's all kinds of ways you can explain it. But from just watching it without hearing Dave's commentary, I was just 100% convinced that Thrawn died. Little disappointed that he didn't die just because I kind of wanted his character to die. I wanted to have that closure with him. But you know, if they're keeping him alive for storytelling reasons, for a future series or story that's going to include Ezra and Sabine and Ahsoka and Jason and all these cool characters, then yeah, it makes sense to keep a villain alive that you can have for those stories too.
Oh, and my favorite death is Rook, because I couldn't stand Rook. He was creepy.
Oh, that was amazing. Like the fact that I wanted him and Zeb to have a fight, right? Like I wanted it to be a rumble in the, I guess, I don't know,
jungle?
Construction dome. the fact that's how he went out, like I love that Zeb got the upper hand, caught him in there and just electrocuted him to death. That was awesome.
Kind of dark.
It was really dark.
A little flippant for like killing a character that way. Yeah.
What did you guys think of the end for Zeb and Callus? Because I thought that was a really... The show is kind of full of like redemptive arcs for people. Like everybody kind of, I mean, Sabine has one, Ezra kind of has one, Kanan has one. And we saw Callus get his redemptive arc too. And I thought that was a really neat way to end, to give them their, you know, Gimli Legolas trip after the Lord of the Rings, where they go visit, you know, the caves, and then Gimli gets to go to the, to Rivendell, you know, that's basically their end. Is that I loved it. I thought it was great.
I mean, the thing that surprised me with this episode is the way it ended. You know, you have the scene where the ghost is flying over Lothal and the citizens are down there and they're kind of revolting against the Empire. And you're like, you're seeing the beginning of the rebellion and the ghost and the crew being a part of that. And you're like, okay, you know, closed scene, like credits, that's the end of the show. And then all of a sudden they give us this surprise, like jump into the future where it's like not even just post Yavin, it's post Endor. And all of our characters that survived through the series are still out there and contributing in their different ways. That blew my mind. I did not expect that to be the ending for the show. And I loved that they did that. And I loved that they surprised me. And kind of what you were asking specifically about Zeb and Callus, I think it's, you know, they were building this friendship. You know, they were, you know, such mortal enemies. And I loved the episode where they were kind of trapped in that cave together and all of that. One of my favorite episodes of the series. And then to have them to build this bond and this friendship. And then now he's getting to see the people that he thought he had taken a part of wiping out, that they're actually thriving and they're accepting him and all of that. Like it's a great closure to their, you know, those two characters story arc.
Yeah, and it's great that Zeb was there, because Zeb is the one who really helped bring Kalis over. It's almost like Kalis went from the dark side to the light side, and Zeb was his guide. And to see that Kalis made the right decision, he's now seeing that, and now seeing that, you know, he didn't exterminate them, and they're still alive, and Zeb standing there with him. That was a great moment. I love that for the two of them.
We finally got the confirmation. Rex was at Endor.
Yes.
So there you go.
Doesn't mean he's the guy in that one scene or not, but he was there.
I'm pretty sure that's what they're implying. I think that's what they're implying,
but I bet if you ask them, they'll say, it could be, it could not be him.
I'm pretty sure Dave, like, I don't know, like, could be, right. You know. Yeah. The thing that blew me away in the end was obviously Ahsoka standing there, and who she is, and Dave having answered the question for fans in the sense that he said every part of her costume means something, and he's not willing to give any details about that costume right now to fans who are looking to cosplay, because he's keeping it a secret, because he hasn't quite figured out what everything means yet. And obviously, I think, you know, if he wants to use Ahsoka in the future, which you can tell he would like to, that there are things that he doesn't want to tie himself into just yet, you know. But just her being there, and clearly Ahsoka the White, was a magnificent thing. Not only that, but the ship that she comes out in is a Jedi ship from the Clone Wars that we've seen, and we hadn't seen a ship like that before. And it's like, where did she dig that up? Because that's not a ship that we have seen, and I'm not amazing with ships, so I don't know the number or the name of it, but it's a type of ship we haven't seen since the Clone Wars, and it was something that the Jedi used a lot. So I just seeing that and who she is and everything, her standing there, just, I was like, yeah, I'm with, Donald Faison. I want that series with her as Sabine looking for Ezra and, you know, what trouble they get into. Like yes, give us that show now.
Yeah. I mean, it almost felt like they were setting up a next series. Like, it would feel almost weird if we don't get that story. Yes. Like, if they did such an obvious setup and put the right characters in the right place for there to be this more story to tell. And mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's smart as a storyteller to give yourself space to tell more stories, but this seems so intentional that if there isn't more, that it would almost feel like we got cheated a little bit. And I think even with, like, Donald Faison and his question, not that it was a setup question, even though it kind of felt like a setup question if you were there, they made it a point to play that question on the Star Wars show when they were doing these highlights. And I think if that was something where they were like, oh, no, we're definitely not going that direction, I feel like they wouldn't have played that clip, because they wouldn't want to fuel that fire. So the fact that the Q&A that they did was over an hour long, of all clips to pick from that Q&A to play.
Yep.
On the Star Wars show, to me, is almost like they're hinting, you know, I'm not saying the next animated series is that, but there's probably some story in the works for them to tell that story.
I'm right there with you. I can't imagine that you would not do that. I mean, it's such an amazing series. And I think that, you know, I want to ask you guys, because I think this does raise a lot of questions, though. About, you know, I mean, if Ahsoka is around during the original trilogy, like, where is she? That's one. But two, if she's around during the sequel trilogy, how does she not end up running into Luke? Like how, you know, and so it seems like the way to answer that is to have her and, you know, Sabine gone on a long journey, looking for Ezra in maybe the unknown regions or something, so that you're not having that question. Because otherwise, I wonder in my heart, it's like, she seems like the perfect person to be helping Luke figure his S out, because apparently he never gets that in order. So, like, if anybody could teach anybody anything about being in tune with the light side of the Force, it should be Ahsoka.
If she's still alive.
Well, she is, though.
Is she?
She's alive at the end of Endor. We saw her.
Yeah, but not necessarily by the
time
of The Last Jedi, is what I'm saying.
Well, no, not the time of The Last Jedi, but I mean, she's still alive in that interim period. Right. So that whole period, she has time to influence
Ahsoka
somehow.
Lives.
So, as she does. So that's the question I wonder then. And so I feel like if you don't do a show to kind of give some sort of answer to that question.
Yeah, I've never had an issue with there being more Jedi around. That we don't.
No, not me either. But
that we don't necessarily see in the movies, because, you know, there's different mediums to tell stories. You know, obviously, you have the books, and the comics, and the TV shows, and the movies, and you don't want to eliminate the ability to use Jedi in all these different mediums. Mm-hmm. So there, yeah. I like the idea that there were other Jedi out there. And Legends overdid that. You know, there were tons of Jedi that actually survived the purge, and you know, were out doing their thing. But I think that there's a way you can have Ahsoka and Ezra out there on their own adventures at the same time that Luke's doing his thing, and not ever have them cross paths. And I'm cool with that. Like I think it'd be cool if they did cross paths, but I'm not expecting it or feeling like it needs to happen in order to, you know, to work.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is true. Well, and again, I do think that they have set it up, in a way that obviously Ahsoka and Sabine are busy. So there's a good reason for them to not necessarily be around the rest of the galaxy at that point. So, and I'm right there with you. I want that series.
And Thrawn's an interesting option too, because, you know, we know his connection to, you know, like if you're going from the novel and stuff, we know that his purpose of joining the Empire is a little deeper than they ever revealed in Rebels. I almost wonder if the continuing stories of Ezra and Sabine and Ahsoka does fit better in, you know, prose as opposed to another animated series, because then they can kind of explore some of that stuff that they maybe never would have touched in an animated series, of like, what is this group that's come, you know, that Thrawn is afraid of, that's out there, that the whole reason he had joined the Empire was to help strengthen the Empire so they could, you know, go against this unknown group that, you know, is still a mystery. You know, so maybe this whole story with Ezra and Sabine and Ahsoka and Thrawn or whoever is involved, they're going to be fighting some other group that's not even associated to
the Empire or
the First Order. So she was busy, you know, while Luke was fighting the First Order. So
no, that's a great point, Aaron. And I think what is very clear, especially from the novelization of The Last Jedi and what we know from Snoke and all that, that the unknown regions really play a huge part in that, and even Palpatine having an idea that there's something out there, right? And so there's a lot going on out there, and they absolutely 100% could have an impact on the galaxy that we know of without anybody else in the galaxy knowing it. So that would be fantastic. And it's a great way to be able to tell those stories and not necessarily have to have all the overlap. So, yeah, absolutely. Gosh, what a great season, I think. And for me, the show really proved itself to be worthy of the mantle of Star Wars, you know, and I think Dave and the team did a fantastic job of finding a way to really tell a pure Star Wars story, I loved it. I loved this end. I loved this season, and I can't wait to now go back and rewatch the entire series. So, I don't really think there's a reason to rate that's not really the reason we're talking about it. But anything else for you guys that just stuck out to you about this season, or any last final thoughts?
Yeah, the thing that really stuck out to me, which is something I've been wanting to get resolved through the whole series, is who is the voice of Chopper? And it was confirmed in the credits that was Dave Filoni. So I'm very excited about that. And I want to see video footage of him doing the voice.
That would be pretty good. That would be a lot of fun. I feel like that could be an extra.
Yeah, I bet we get that. We get that on the Blu-ray.
What about you, Aaron? Any final thoughts on Rebels as a series and the season 4?
I mean, it exceeded my expectations. The series did. I know when it was first announced and kind of the way they described it, I was like, okay, this is cool. This sounds kind of cool, but you know, not necessarily, you know, it's never exactly what you think it's going to be or exactly what you hope for. You know, it's just not how these things work. Typically you don't, they don't make a TV series and you're like, oh, that's exactly everything that I wanted. You know, like yeah. it always surprises you. And this series, big time. Like I just didn't expect to care as much about the characters as I did. And I feel like they've introduced a group of Star Wars characters that I didn't even realize that were essential to Star Wars. You know, this series didn't even exist however many years ago. And I didn't even know that a character, you know, I didn't know any of these characters even were going to exist. And I was fine with that. But now, like, I couldn't imagine them not being a part of Star Wars. So some of my favorite characters of all time in Star Wars are on the show. And I think they did a great job. I'm not saying everything was perfect. There were times I didn't like episodes. There were criticisms that I had of certain things they did. But as an overall entity, I really loved Star Wars Rebels and thought it was a great addition to the canon.
Absolutely, 100% agree. So, and I'm so glad that we got an opportunity to sit down and talk about it. You know, I kind of feel like I've been chomping at the bit to want to discuss Rebels and the season and just it's been a fantastic ride. And I'm right there with you, Aaron. You know, I know when the show was announced, I was very skeptical. And I also vocalized, you know, opinions that I had about the show that, you know, when I didn't feel like it was kind of living up to its promise, or what it could be. And I feel like by the end of the season, this season, and by the end of the show, they really brought that to a head and full circle. They made it in the end a worthy successor to the Clone Wars, as an animated show. And I'm very thankful now that they told this story. It really gave me a whole new group of characters to really cherish in the Star Wars saga, and some of my favorite characters now. As we talked about, you know, for me, there are very few characters Jedi-wise that now kind of rival Kanan and Ezra, and I never thought that was going to be the case. So it's fantastic work, and I from me myself, and I know from both of you, we want to say a huge thank you to everybody involved with Rebels, the team there. You did fantastic work. The voice talent behind the scenes was amazing for each one of these characters. Everybody working on the show, I think the last season, the animation team and the lighting team really stepped up their game. In so many ways, the lighting specifically on the last like six episodes was just phenomenal. The music, Kevin Kiner did amazing work, you know, really adding to Rebels and to the Star Wars audio library, what I think of as Star Wars music. Great job. So thank you so much. We really appreciate all the hard work that you put in, and I think we're all just on the edge of our seats waiting to figure out what you guys have next for us. So thanks for joining us for the show. Make sure you check us out all over the place. Want to say a huge thank you to Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson, associate producers here through Patreon. Their support has meant the world to me on this show and for the network. They make sure that everything we do here on Trek FM keeps coming to you each and every week. Trek FM is a huge network, and we can't do it without you. And the way that you can support us is by going to patreon.com/trekfm and seeing all the different support levels we have. Honestly, in the end, every little bit helps. So again, go over to patreon.com/trekfm and just become part of the team. Guys, thank you so much for joining me. I love having both of you on. I love that podcasting brought both of us together. All of us as friends. I mean, it's amazing. Star Wars and podcasting is what gave me two amazing friends here. And so, Aaron, before I let you go, where can everybody find you and let everybody know what podcast you're doing so they know what they should be subscribing to?
So I do a few podcasts. Star Wars Bookworms I do with Teresa Delgado. We talk about all the Star Wars books, comics, reference guides, all of that stuff. So you can find us on Twitter, the normal places. Just look for Star Wars Bookworms. You'll find us. And then I also do Star Scavengers, which is a podcast that was mainly focused on the Freemaker Adventures. That series has now come to an end. But we are still doing episodes here and there about just Lego sets and just Star Wars in general. So if anybody's interested in a more Lego focused podcast, check out Star Scavengers.
And it's good. It's good.
And then I also do a Doctor Who podcast, which we're kind of on a hiatus because Doctor Who's on a hiatus. But when the new episodes start with the new Doctor, which is should be really exciting because it sounds like they're making tons of changes to everything. We'll be back on the air with that. So that's called Bad Wolf Radio. And yeah, that's pretty
much
my
favorite
it.
Doctor Who podcast. Yeah, so definitely check that
out. And I'm on Twitter at AV Goins.
Well, Bruce, man, it's always good to have you here in the 602 Club. Where can everybody find you, man?
Well, when I'm not in Orlando with Aaron doing Star Wars Secrets of the Empire, the
like
VR
you guys
thing.
Are there all the time. Like, I'm so jealous. I hate you both. No, I don't. I
we,
love
we
you
hate
both.
You
I'm
too. I mean, we love you too.
Yeah, I know.
You can find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex, and you can find me talking Star Wars on the Star Wars Report podcast. And you can find me here on the Trek FM network with Dan Gunther doing Literary Treks, your official Star Trek books and comics podcast of Trek FM. And I'm always in the Babel Conference.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram under the same name. You can find me here on the network also doing The Orb with Chris Jones with just talking all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We really do hope to be back to that soon as we've kind of been on hiatus a little bit as well. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network doing Outposts with Drea Kaufman, all about Harry Potter. One chapter at a time, we're walking through that series. So make sure you check that out. It's a lot of fun. We are in just the beginning of The Goblet of Fire. So it's a great time to join us. If you've read the series a million times or if you've never read it, it's a fun podcast. I think you'll enjoy it. You also find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking all about Star Wars. We actually have a massive Star Wars Rebels episode that is dropping next week as we're recording this. And we have a very, very, very special guest. So I hope you'll check that out as well as the show. If you love Star Wars, it's definitely a podcast for you. It is the podcast you were looking for. And then, of course, you can find me on Cinema Stories with Courtney as we talk all about films, the ones of faith. But thank you so much for joining us, and may the Force be with you.